can you hear me?
Yes.
Claudia, thank you very much. I'm very happy to welcome Professor Claudia von Werloff of the University of Innsbruck, Institute for Research on Patriarchy. Now, let's start with a brief that you wrote to Greta Thunberg. I read it some minutes ago. I read it aloud on the radio. In this letter, you tell, among others, that the disruption of the global climate is not due to CO2. Where can we find scientific evidence for this, since the mainstream information tells us every day that the climate disruption is due to CO2? Can you please tell us more? Because we hear this every day. It's some kind of a mantra.
And yes, that's what I'm in 4 years now. And, well, there are two problems. The first thing, what is climate change? And the second, what does it have to do with CO2? So there are two problems, because what we consider climate change, at least in the official discussion, is called global warming. And this global warming doesn't exist. I mean, there are data from NASA, which is the North American Space Agency, and they show that in the last 18 years, there was no general global warming. So this doesn't exist. What exists, indeed, because we are not deniers of the problem, is a general change in different dimensions, in the weather, in the climate, and more in the atmosphere, etc. We are going to explain this more in this interview. And the second is the CO2 question, which is now very prominent, and all these young people are now on the street because they believe in this story, in this dogma of the CO2. And this is very strange, because a lot of scientists, of real scientists, are denying the influence of CO2 as a negative one, or as an influence at all. For example, there are about 30,000 scientists in the U.S. now who say that there is no problem with CO2. On the contrary, CO2, this is a gas that stems from rotten natural materials, which is needed by the plants to transform it in oxygen. So they say that this is not at all detrimental for the climate, and it is even something we have to welcome, something we need for our trees and our plants, and as a positive effect. So, but the funniest thing is that CO2 is often shown as some dirt, as if it was a dirt in the air. You know, when you look at the factories, or they're always shown the factories and the dust coming out, etc. This is not CO2. CO2 is a gas that is invisible and doesn't smell, so you don't even see it. And in general, it is so... The amount of CO2 in the air, in the atmosphere, is about 0.038% only. And most of that is vapor. It's just water vapor. Maybe some 80 or 70%. So this tiny amount of CO2, it cannot change something huge like the climate, the global climate of this planet. This is impossible. So all these scientists who are really serious scientists are denying a possible negative influence of CO2 on the climate. There are even winners of the Nobel Prize, etc., like Eva Gerber, who are explaining it, or people like from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, like Richard Lindzen and others, who are really serious scientists. And the IPCC, that is the International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, founded in the end of the 80s of the last century. This is a political organization that is propagating and proposing the CO2 myth. So this is a political question. And from the point of view of a real scientist, CO2 is not really something detrimental and is not really changing any climate. It's too tiny for that. So you see, there is a real problem. And if you look at the foundations, when this came about, this happened in the 80s, at the end of the 80s, and before this time, all the world spoke about a possible ice age, a new ice age, like Lowell Ponte with his book on the cooling. It was a book from 1976. They spoke about a cooling and a new ice age in contrast to the global warming we are speaking of today. So there is really no historical debate anymore about how this came about. And the IPCC was founded by, well, think tanks like the Club of Rome and like the World Watch Institute and the Rockefellers, etc. So people who have different interests in the whole question. And they found, I mean, this was an analysis by William Engdahl, who said they founded or they invented the myth with CO2 in order to have a common enemy defined, which is humanity, because humanity is producing so much, and civil industry, etc., they are producing so much CO2, and they can take this ideology for another plan, for another policy. So this was the origin of this myth, and it has now been propagated worldwide with Al Gore and all these people, and everybody believes in it. This is very funny, and contrasting with the fact that that a real climate change is not occurring in the sense they are defining it, you know?
Yeah.
This is generally not known. This history is not known, and people really don't know anything about nature and about the planet. So there is a certain ignorance generally in the public, and they just believe in everything. So very funny. Well, this is the other effect. So what is changing? There are a lot of changes in the world, in the climate, and in many aspects of the like Rosalie Battelle, we are speaking about her later, who said we are wrecking our planet. But how? It's not global warming, and this is a totally different aspect which is not mentioned by these people who speak about climate change. They don't see that there are changes, but very different ones and with very different origins.
Yeah.
So this is for the first... this is my first statement on that question.
Yeah. It seems also that computer models predicting catastrophic global warming in the coming years are parameterized. There is a risk of framing the outcome of these mathematical models high risk. Can you say something about
these models? The IPCC is using computer models. This is just an outcome of computer simulation. It has nothing to do with reality. And what they are measuring is what they want to measure. They just measure something like more CO2 output, but they do not consider all the complexity of the climate on this planet. They have no parameters about them, and so they are really trying to fool us with what they are saying about such a big amount of climate or of global warming. This is not happening. It's not happening, and it will not happen, at least not because of CO2. So these are really strange methods that are not really scientific methods. One should say they are political methods because they want to prove something, which is not the case. So there is no reason why there should be an amount, such a global warming of until, they say, about 4%, which is impossible. At least it is impossible with simply putting CO2 as a measure. With this tiny amount of CO2 in the air, you would never have any, effect. And that it is very funny that everybody is believing this nonsense. It's a theory, but it has nothing to do with reality, and we should look at why this theory exists. So this is maybe the more important question.
Yeah. Some 30 years ago, we already warned that the protective ozone layer had been reduced. Nowadays, we don't seem to care anymore for ozone depletion in the stratosphere. How could this be explained? Because we have to be concerned about the depletion of ozone. And where does it come from?
The ozone, yes. This is a very funny thing, and it's not funny at all in the end, because the ozone layer is really something that we need to have on Earth. Without the ozone layer, there would be no life on Earth, because it protects us from cosmic radiation, from the sun, especially UV, C and B radiation, which is very toxic. And we have found that this radiation today is coming down to Earth, which normally is prevented by the ozone layer. But now it comes through. And this is a longer story, because there was the Montreal Protocol in the 80s, which prohibited the use of CFS, all these methods, all these chemicals you have in the refrigerators, etc., because they thought it was the reason. But this was wrong already then, because we know that what is really destroying ozone is especially radioactivity. And radioactivity is a lot of radioactivities in the air since the military was experimenting with nuclear explosions since the 40s and 50s until the 90s, the end of the 90s, we had about 2,200 nuclear explosions on Earth and in the atmosphere, and they have produced a lot of radiation, of radioactive radiation that is destroying the ozone layer. This is the main reason for the weakness of this layer, because radioactivity is somehow eating up the ozone so that it is suffocating in a way, because ozone is a sort of atmospheric oxygen, and radioactivity is finishing with the oxygen. So the problem is something like a suffocation and a toxic effect of the radiation coming down on Earth, then when this layer is destroyed or inhibited. So last year we found that all the people who were measuring ozone found that it was weaker than ever. It did not recover as was proposed after the Montreal Protocol, and that in the contrary, it is not only existing in form of holes in the Arctic or in the Antarctic, in the Arctic only since Fukushima, with all the radioactivity. There was never a hole in the Arctic before. And now we have an ozone depletion even over the whole northern half of the Earth. So not only on the poles, but generally, and it comes down and it is destroying a lot of plants, a lot of low life like insects, with the insects dying, the birds, and the whole food chain is really affected by the weakness of the ozone layer. And in the oceans, you have the plankton dying and the krill, all that what the big fishes are eating. And you have now many fish who are dying from hunger. And you have a dying coral reefs, like, for example, the Great Barrier Reef east of New Zealand, the biggest one in the world of coral reefs, is now somehow dying and is not reproducing itself anymore. So, and then people say it is because the oceans are warming up and have a warmer water, but this cannot be measured. It's not true. It's but the main problem is that toxic radiation from the sun comes down into the water as well, and it is killing and making this life in the oceans die. And then you have all this radioactivity from Fukushima, which is let into the Pacific, so that life in the Pacific is dying out nearly. So soon we will have no fish anymore. Well, this is somehow very tragical, because Rosalie Bertell, who wrote this book on Planet Earth, The Latest Weapon of War, she was really studying all these problems and where they stem from. And she always warned about the ozone layer because it had been thinned out already by 10% in the end of the 90s, and now it's becoming more thinner and thinner. And she said with 20% thinning of the ozone layer, there will be no agriculture on Earth anymore.
Yeah.
Because the plants will be destroyed by this toxical. When you can see that even on your balcony, when you have the plants and the sun is already starting, that the leaves are getting brown, and it's they are not growing much, your plants in the fresh air. So this is maybe the biggest problem we are facing as a result of many, many effects which are destroying the ozone layer, not only radioactivity, but also other instruments of war, one has to say, war against Earth, that are much worse than any global warming.
Yeah. What can we say about geoengineering, and especially stratospheric aerosol injection, which is one of the technology that the IPCC is, in a way, not suggesting, but they say it can be a solution for the global warming. What do you think of it?
Well, if the global warming was the problem, I mean, yes, that on the basis of this wrong theory of global warming and CO2, there are now civil and geoengineers existing, something that didn't exist in previous times, and like Caldera, Keith, and Lowell, Wood, etc., and to plan to have a solution for this pseudo problem, which is supposed to be a solar radiation management, SRM or SAI, in which they are somehow injecting aerosols into the air to block the sun from shining and from heating up the world. So instead of removing CO2, their plan, because this is politically not possible somehow, they promote this other solution to fight against the effects of global warming, of so-called global warming, and this would be blocking the sun from shining too much on Earth, something like that. And so their plan is to inject aerosols into the atmosphere, and especially David Keith from Harvard University has his project, Scopex is his project, in which he tries to inject even sulfuric acid into the atmosphere, imitating something like a volcanic eruption. And they call it the Pinatubo effect, because the Pinatubo was a volcano that exploded in 1991, and all the ashes and all what came out had the effect of cooling down the climate in worldwide. And they are trying to imitate this effect by adding sulfuric acid into the air. And recently, David Keith, this professor from this University of Harvard, even said that 10,000 of people would die from that, at least, because this would mean to have acids down on Earth, which is destroying all life, possibly. I mean, these are really crazy experiments they are planning. And they go as civil engineers and geoengineers. And the funny thing about this movement of civil geoengineering that is now a part of nearly every university in the world, nearly, is that they do not speak of the military background of all these technologies they are now propagating. And all these movements about climate justice, etc., don't know anything about it as well. This is simply denied that these are military experiments, which we know already since 30 years about that, called like the spraying of the atmosphere, but that is occurring already. I mean, that is nothing new. We have it already in form of the spraying of barium and aluminium and other substances that are very bad for the agriculture. And Monsanto, for example, invented a seed that is resistant to aluminium. Imagine. So things like that are occurring, and the people are against it, but they don't see that these experiments are occurring already as part of geoengineering, military geoengineering that exists already since about 70 or more years. This is a product of the Second World War, in which the military invented the treating the nuclear as a weapon of war, and after the nuclear they invented other means of weather control. Of as Rosalie Battelle said, they invented weather war, they invented geoengineering, and they invented plasma weapons, which are electromagnetic weapons used by emitted by ionospheric heaters. This is a very special technology, mostly not known, which are based on the inventions of Nikola Tesla, who was a physicist and inventor of the 19th and 20th century. So this is a special technology which is not very well known. Only HAARP in Alaska is one of these ionospheric heaters, which are working with electromagnetic waves that are artificially produced and reach something like a billion watts and things like that. And they are shooting then up into the ionosphere to produce certain effects, leading them back to the Earth. So this is a very, very dangerous technology, which can also be used for producing all kinds of natural, so-called natural catastrophes, for example, tsunamis or earthquakes or volcanic eruptions or the change of weather in whole regions and producing hurricanes, droughts, fires, and floods. So even the ocean, changing the ocean currents, these are technologies that are not discussed in public, but that exist already since the Vietnam War. They have been invented during this time. And the UN Convention on Environmental Modification, this is the famous ENMOD Convention from 1977, explains these weapons and explains the effects they may have or when they are used. So it's not even a secret, and it's decades ago that they have been invented and are in experimentation. And it's like a war that is fought against the Earth as a planet and as a whole macro being on which we depend. So this is very, very dangerous, and this is exactly Rosalie Battelle who has explained us how they are functioning. So the post-nuclear weapons of electromagnetic mass destruction, And you know, we have these ionospheric heaters are now and they are about
what
4
is
dozen.
A ionospheric heaters? What is the why do they use it? What's the idea? And we don't understand because there is a global warming. They say that there is a global warming, so you are heating the ionosphere.
Yeah, they're heating.
It's crazy.
They are heating the ionosphere. The ionosphere is a sphere in the atmosphere that starts about 80 kilometers until about 1,000 kilometers. It is an electrified part of the atmosphere. And when they send the electromagnetic waves up there, they are heating them up because when they heat the atmosphere, the ionosphere, or this part of the atmosphere, which is called ionosphere, they can manage these rays to come down on Earth again. So something like making a curve, you know, and you have an angle and you can... Rosalie said it's like a gun from the ionosphere, which is directed against the Earth. And when this ray comes down again to the Earth, it is destructive at the utmost.
Yeah,
I mean, it can even pass through the core of the Earth.
But it's also
rays.
Warming. So, I mean...
Yeah, warming is
it's
because
completely
you need the... It's
crazy,
yeah.
Because we have too much warming. And we are sending
they are
some...
warming the because the warming is up there. It's not down here. If there is any warming... I mean, they didn't find a real warming of the Earth in general. But you have different parts of the world that are warming up or have been warmed up, like the poles, polar regions, and in the mountains where the melting glaciers are. But this has nothing to do with a general global warming through CO2. But these are effects of military use of, for example, ionospheric heaters.
Yes.
You can, for example, there was. In
it's unbelievable.
74, there was a treaty between the USA and the Soviet Union at that time in 74, and they had the Vladivostok Treaty, in which they planned together to heat up the Arctic because they wanted the ice go away to get there down there to get to the oil on the ground of the Northern Sea. And they couldn't get there because of the ice. And now you have already half of the Arctic melted down because they used electromagnetic waves for that. Alpha waves, they are extremely low frequency waves. And they have torn the Arctic with that. It had nothing to do with global warming, but with the military technology.
Yeah. And what do we know, going back to geoengineering, to solar radiation management, do we have evidence that it is, that the program is on? I mean, we see all these kind of trails in the sky, and the sky is completely sometimes covered by these trails.
Yeah.
They are persistent, staying the whole time. What do you think about that?
Yes,
phenomenal.
It is an older military technology which is in implemented since about 30 years. It started in the 90s, and for example, you have effects in parts like Shasta in California. They have through by these sprayings of what are called chemtrails. Sometimes chemtrail is a word used by the military, but it's not really showing what is done. I mean, it's like Agent Orange that was sprayed on Vietnam by a toxic product by Monsanto, and it's like that. It's toxic, and like for example, this community of Shasta in Northern California, they have a land which is not producing anymore. Everybody is sick, and the animals and plants are dying because they have had such a load of toxic materials, aerosols coming down from the sky that they are dying. And they have made a big event there some years ago to protest against that. But funnily enough, all these alternative and social movements do not accept, even ETC group, which is very important in that respect, they do not accept that this has been done, which is a reality for these people, and they are denying and are discussing only the bad effects which would have which this method would have on us, you know. So they are against it, but they are denying that it is in use already everywhere. Yeah. And we have that, of course, you see it in the sky. And I have done some research about why they are doing it. I mean, from the military is not interested in any global warming question. They're even denying global warming because they know how it's coming about because of themselves. So
they are doing that.
Yeah, they are doing that. So they know better, like Trump, who is against, who knows it by the military. And so they know it. But I found out that as they are not interested in any global warming question or so, they are doing it because of the ozone depletion. Where is an ozone hole or a weakness, they cannot pass their electromagnetic waves. They need I call it a replacement atmosphere. They need a replacement atmosphere to come through as a conductor. They need an atmosphere that is conductive, and this is the reason why they are using so many metals in the spraying. Heavy metals like barium and strontium and aluminium, which is not heavy metal but metal, and they are all conductive for rays, you know.
Yeah.
And recently I came about a research of a woman of seemingly German origin called Schmidt, who lives in Venezuela. She made an analysis of these rays of being protective against the outside, against the cosmos, something like a Faraday cage. It is something like bringing a sort of grid around the Earth to protect her from radiation coming in, and this has also to do with the ozone depletion. The ozone layer is really central, has become the central question that has to get us alarmed, really, because this is the moment of truth. When we are not able to prevent these things happening, this destruction happening, we will die out in within 20 or 30 years.
But in the official storytelling, nobody's talking about the ozone depletion.
Mm-hmm.
That's very strange.
This was an alarm last year, and there was a colleague in the U.S., Marvin Herndon. He was making research about that question together with his colleagues, and he published that. I published this then here. I mean, I know him as well, or knew him then as well. And he proved, he made really experiments proving that the ozone depletion leads to the arrival of toxic radiation on Earth, down on Earth. And he found even out that the NASA, the same North American space agency, has found about that. The same results already in 2007. So, and they didn't do anything. I mean, they know it already, and they didn't do anything because, you know, the military thinks it can do everything it wants. It is really, they think it's not, well, if they need it, they would invent a new ozone layer, you know. This is what they think. Yeah. They think they have taken...
They think they can find a technical solution for everything.
Yeah, klar. Yeah. And they think they are able to do whatever they want and to prevent things from happening, but they didn't even... I mean, all these nuclear explosions in the atmosphere and in the ionosphere and in the Van Allen belts and in the which destroyed parts of the magnetic field of the Earth, etc., horrible things, they could never replace or cure. Yeah. The atmosphere, they couldn't do anything about it. They destroyed it, and it's destroyed. So this is one of the reasons of weather changes as well. So there are a lot of very complex reasons of why things are happening. For example, you can even use electromagnetic waves from the ionospheric heaters. You can use them to move the jet streams. The jet streams are somehow waves around the Earth that are building the frontier between hot and cold. So, you know, so if you are moving them north, you have all the heat from the south in the north, and yeah. when you are moving them down south, you have the cold from the Arctic in the middle of Europe, or even at the
they influence in the strongly the climate and the weather.
Yeah, you can. Okay. Yeah, you can with these methods, you can do nearly everything. And if you can change the vapor streams that are the humid streams around the vapor streams around the Earth, you can transport humidity to Arabia, for example. This is one of the biggest businesses at the moment, because the people there need water, and you can just transform the water from here to there. So you always have more. Even snow falling down in the South Arabian deserts, you know. Yeah. This is all manipulation, weather manipulation, climate manipulation nobody speaks about, but it's occurring every day. And even this effect of when the atmosphere is full of metal, it is drying out. So we have much less rain in Europe, for example. Yeah. Which has nothing to do with warming.
We have drought in Italy. There is
in Italy, a growing it's drying drought. Out.
Yeah,
and you have then the fires, which are also induced, not only because it's dry, but you have direct energy weapons, laser weapons, and everything you can use. So you can produce that these fires that are happening, as it was happening in Portugal, in Australia, and in California. They have nothing to do with wildfires or so, and they are not destroying the plants, but they are destroying the buildings. It's like a war that has passed through there. I mean, all these things are just discussed as being a result of global warming, have nothing to do with that. And so this whole CO2 question is used, and global warming is used to distract people from what is really happening, so that they don't see what has been done to the planet and to the atmosphere and to the weather and etc. So they wouldn't look at it, because they think it's all global warming.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we have almost to close the program, but I would like to ask you something. At the end, May 23rd to 26th, we will have European elections. They're coming. What can we do as concerned Europeans to put climate engineering and all related risks on the electoral agenda? Because we expect European institutions protect 300 million citizens from the risks of these extremely dangerous technologies.
Yes.
What can we do?
What we did, at least, is we are just now publishing a book that it is called Global Warning, not Warming, but Warning.
That's good.
It is going to appear there, but doesn't people, women are explaining their research and about what we are talking about now in that book, and this will be published in the Talma Studios International in Dublin. So this book, I can recommend it. But I mean, what the problem is that people don't know, and they don't get informed, even if this is possible. The book of Rosalie Battelle exists in the fourth edition in German. It exists in Italian, exists in French and in Spanish. Everybody can read it. And, you know, many people have bought it, because the fourth edition, it is now 15,000 times here in existing, and somebody should have read it, but people don't speak about it. I don't know what to do, and the parties that are running for election have nothing to do with all the Greens should be those who should be most interested in this question, but they are not. They are sold to, I mean, you have to see that behind the whole question of climate change, etc., there must be somebody who wants people to be distracted and to be organized around other issues. And you have the whole smart city and 5G movement, all this artificial the technification of the society, and a sort of reduction of production and consumption, it is like the depopulation agenda of certain people, which is, it should be related to that. I mean, I think there are really other plans and the New World Order and things behind it. And this CO2 is only the scapegoat to prevent people from looking at it. And the Greens, for example, are totally involved into these plans of a form of a eventually more green economy, and which is not the case. It's not a green economy. It's a technified economy which we are looking, which is approaching us. And I don't see the left has no interest in the whole question because they are concerned about progress and development. To say it like that, you need a critique of these technologies of the, I call it military alchemy, what we have here. But they are not interested in that, and the other parties, in any case, not at all. So I don't know who is going to be interested from the point of view of the parties. And the people are not informed, and they don't get informed, and people who speak about it are called conspiracy theories, etc. So, I mean, how to have that change, the change from looking, from believing in these ideologies that come from above, how can people like this Greta and the young people get informed about the reality? They should know what is really going on and not what is supposed to go on. So this is the problem. I don't know how to do that. This is why I wrote this letter to Greta Thunberg, to get her informed. And as I know, she even recognized ultimately that there is a military problem, but not just the one we are discussing of geoengineering.
Did she answer you?
Yeah, no, of course not.
Of course
but
not.
But at least, no, because there is a big movement behind her. Mm. The CO2 movement is behind her, of course.
Yeah.
And there has been plans since 7 years. They are discussing how to mobilize the youth. Yeah. So this is no just an adventure of the people, but this is an organized campaign of the other side, you know.
Claudia, we have to stop, unfortunately, but we will present your book when it's going to come out. And maybe we can present the book of Rosalie Bertel one more time, because our task is to inform people. So we do what we can to inform people.
Yeah, maybe you can translate it into Netherlands.
Yeah, maybe it could be an idea. Unfortunately, I have to stop, but I thank you very much for being with us this evening, and I hope to speak to you again. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. En we hadden het in gesprek met professor Dr. Claudia von Verloof, Women's Studies Institute for Political Sciences at the University of Innsbruck. En haar instituut is het Innsbruck Institute for Research on Patriarchy in Oostenrijk. Dit was Radio Onda Italiana, Voice of the Town. Vanavond in de studio Silvia Terribili. Hartelijk dank voor jullie aandacht en graag tot de volgende keer.
High frequency active auroral research project. High frequency active auroral research project. And this is a project operating here in Alaska, just about 250 miles northeast of Anchorage.
What does this project consist? You discussed in the book that it involves using so-called atmospheric heaters, basically radio antenna, and in phased array to radiate energy into the ionosphere in the upper atmosphere. How does that work for people that do not understand either radio or the physics of the ionosphere. Could you briefly explain how this is actually going to work?
Sure. What they've done is they've developed a system. It's actually a field of antennas, and they're about 70 feet high. At this particular time, there are 48 constructed antennas. And what they do is by energizing them with electrical energy, which is converted to radio frequency energy, it radiates from these antennas in what's called a phased array grid. So they fire them in series to cause the energy, the radio frequency energy, to focus to a relatively small area in the ionosphere. And this is the first phase of a multi-level phase. This first phase will actually produce an effective radiated power of 1 billion watts. And then it's scheduled to go to 4 billion watts approximately in the second phase, and then a anticipated level eventually by the planners of 100 billion watts of effective radiated power.
So basically these are radio antenna, which are going to be broadcasting energy into the ionosphere. The ionosphere is a critical element of the Earth's ecosystem and has profound implications for those creatures, human and otherwise, living on it. Can you briefly, Nick, explain to us what the ionosphere is, how it serves the Earth?
Sure. The ionosphere is an area. It's approximately 30 to 600 miles above the Earth's surface, and it's an energized area, and it acts more or less as a filter or a screen against incoming radiations that would be quite damaging. For instance, X-rays and cosmic rays are screened out in the ionosphere. And this is extremely important because when you compare it to, say, the ozone layer, which is screening out ultraviolet, which can cause skin cancers and severe sunburn, what we're talking about here is something much much more important in terms of its environmental impact. This is a very critical area of our environment. It's also the area that radio signals are bounced off of to get the effect of radio over large areas. In this case, however, the radio frequency energy they're utilizing is for specific weapons applications.
We're going to talk about some of those specific projected applications in just a few minutes. The book is subtitled Advances in Tesla Technology. I realize this is a big subject, but Nikola Tesla, can you briefly tell us, for those members of the audience who are not familiar with that man and his work, who he was, what he worked on, and how the technologies involved in Project HARP are relevant to and developments of Tesla technology?
Sure. Tesla was a quite brilliant inventor. In fact, in the 1880s, he was had developed the entire system of AC power generation and transmission. And that's what we operate in our households on today. In fact, people remember Edison as the pioneer in electrical energy and its uses for practical uses and application. However, Tesla's applications were much more readily utilized by the American world as a whole. In fact, that's what we use today. But he was also involved in advanced weapons research and other technologies, including beaming electrical energy from one part of the planet to another, which is sort of an overlap on the HARP program in one particular application. But when you look at HARP, what you find and what we found is 12 basic patents surrounding the technology. And within this patent cluster, the lead patents were by a gentleman by the name of Bernard Eastland. Dr. Eastland was actually, his whole creative stimulus behind the HARP transmitter was based on Tesla's original work and some of the theories of Tesla regarding weapons applications. Although the actual technology is probably quite different, the idea is essentially the same, creating in Eastland and Tesla's case a shield to protect the United States from weapon systems that might be engaged against us. And that's really where the root of this invention rests.
Basically using beamed energy in order to alter the atmosphere in such a way as to generate a number of different military applications. We're going to talk about some of those specific applications in a couple of minutes. The patents that you alluded to, by the way, Bernard Eastland's last name is E-A-S-T-L-U-N-D, is it not?
That's correct, and he's actually a really good guy. I mean, we've had a number of conversations, and just he's a very brilliant man, and a number of the applications that we uncovered were things that he just did not anticipate. But that's the way it is in science. People specialize. They don't always see the big picture.
The patents that you alluded to, those 12 patents, have gone through a number of corporate sponsors or ownership. Three companies that figure prominently in the development of the HARP system are APTI, the mysterious E-Systems, and Raytheon. Could you briefly, Dr. Begich, explain these three companies, the relationship between them, and how they came to acquire and perhaps utilize these patents?
Sure. APTI is actually was actually a first-line subsidiary of ARCO, Atlantic Richfield Company, which is the largest oil and gas company operating in Alaska, owning approximately half of the natural gas on the North Slope, which amounts to many trillions of cubic feet. Now, this natural gas currently has no market, so ARCO was going out to look for a way to develop those gas fields and actually find a way to use the energy in place. So they hired Bernard Eastland essentially to do that, to find a way to use this energy in some meaningful application. And what he came up with was the HARP transmitter for military application. Now, what became of that is ARCO began pursuing this whole area. They sold the military on the concept in the mid-80s, and they formed a subsidiary, APTI, around Eastland. And Eastland actually ran the company in its formative years. In that period of time, ARCO advanced a series of patents going up into the early 1990s, where in which they developed the technology even further beyond what Eastland had originally envisioned, scaling down the power requirements for certain applications and so forth. What happened then is ARCO continued to develop, and they actually bid on this project against Raytheon Corporation initially and another bidder. And ARCO Power Technologies was reported to be only a $5 million a year company with no military contracting experience as a subsidiary of its mother company. Now, Raytheon, on the other hand, their competitor at that time, was a $10 billion a year company, one of the largest military contractors in the world, and they lost a $30 million initial contract to a company that didn't even post $5 million a year in sales. So this was, first of all, you know, quite anomalous in the sense of public contracting policy, but the only way that such contracts are gained are when one company has proprietary information or special information unique to it. In this case, it was these 12 patents which formed the base for what would become basic science for a ground-based Star Wars weapons technology, which is what and how we characterize the HARP program. What then happened is E-Systems, in June of 1994, bought out ARCO Power Technologies Incorporated, bought them out entirely, and the patents as well as the second phase contract on the project. Now, E-Systems is an interesting one. They made 60 Minutes a year or so ago, and they also made the front page of the Washington Post as one of the most secret companies in the United States, doing $2.1 billion a year in sales, of which $1.8 billion were for security agencies, military intelligence groups, CIA, and others. And of that, $800 million are black projects, projects so secret that even the United States Congress is unaware of what they are. Now the interesting twist, Raytheon then comes in, and they buy out E-Systems, lock, stock, and barrel. So here you have this big circle. You have Raytheon on the one hand bidding and losing, and now in the end ending up gaining this basic technology and the patent. And the interesting part is Raytheon owns thousands of patents, so these 12 now disappear into their mix. Very difficult to extract where they came from or the chain of assignment. Unless they had been pulled prior to those transfers. And that's when we pulled the original files, and that's what our files indicate was ARCO Power Technologies was the root, and the end owner is Raytheon, now one of the most powerful military contractors in the world.
And this, again, via E-Systems, to a certain extent mysterious and certainly sub rosa slash covert military and military contractor with ties to the intelligence community. Now, with regard to the specific applications of Project HARP to various areas of military activity, one of the applications that you mentioned is missile detection, and in terms of determining the difference between dummy warheads and real warheads, and also defense against guided missile attack through altering the atmosphere in such a way as to neutralize those missiles. Can you explain how Project HARP is projected as doing this?
Sure. There's actually three patents surrounding that particular idea, along with an article that we found sort of after we published, but one showing that the former Soviet Union had developed a similar technology. But essentially what they can do is they can create an over-the-horizon radar effect. And what's interesting is this site where it's located, where HARP is currently built, is the old site of the backscatter radar station. And this particular station was abandoned theoretically after the Cold War ended. However, when you read the patents and you look at the technology, this technology was far superior to the old over-the-horizon technology that they had up to that point developed. This technology will look over the curvature of the Earth and detect incoming objects from ionospheric levels, which we had said earlier were quite high, several miles above the Earth, all the way down to the surface. So you're even able to detect, in this instance, cruise missiles. Now, what can also happen is by increasing the energy output of these devices, these radio frequency transmitters, it'll create a field around the incoming objects that then, using gamma ray detectors, they can actually determine which objects are carrying nuclear payloads and which ones are decoys. And this is important because in a nuclear threat cloud, which is the way they characterize an attack, we might have as many as, say, 100,000 incoming objects, which only a few will actually carry warheads. And the objective of having all those decoys is you figure some will get through. Well, with this technology, they would be able to discriminate between those that are decoys and those carrying nuclear warheads. And then by adding even more power into the antenna array and subsequently into the ionosphere bouncing back to the Earth, they're actually able to cause bit errors on the onboard computers, which causes them to malfunction and crash. So this is pretty versatile in those three particular applications. There are three patents surrounding that. All of them are now held by the company in control of this particular project. So it is, in a sense, a very sophisticated, not only detection device in this application, but also one that can actually destroy those incoming objects.
Can you briefly explain for the layperson, of whom I am one, how this phased antenna array will accomplish, or is projected as accomplishing these tasks? In other words, what is the physical mechanism involved?
Okay, what they do is by firing these antenna in a specific way, they're able to create a focusing ability, and with that, they're able to then bounce using a smaller array, which there is one located here called High Pass up near Fairbanks. They're able to bounce the signal off of this artificial plasma layer, or this layer of energy that they're able to place in the upper atmosphere, and they're able to maneuver this like a mirror. It can be pictured as a hand mirror bouncing light, only in this case it's a energy mirror bouncing radio frequency energy over the horizon, and that's essentially the basic mechanism. It's a two-pronged or two-array approach in that particular application.
Now, the term plasma, something you refer to frequently in your book, very briefly, for the layperson, that is?
Well, when you look at it in this application, it's cold plasma. It's actually got a low temperature in comparison to what most people think of in terms of high-energy plasmas. But what it essentially is it's by rapidly scanning and more or less painting in the ionosphere using this device, they're able to create what could be characterized as a wall of a standing wall of energy, if you will. That's, I think, the simplest way to characterize it.
Another of the applications that you discuss is something called deep earth tomography. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, this is actually what is funded for this year. It goes in conjunction with the with another application that I'll mention briefly. It's the idea of creating an ELF, extremely low frequency. And what happens is the primary frequency of this device fires into the ionosphere and it pulses. And by pulsing the primary frequency acting as more or less a carrier, what it does is it converts the ionosphere into a very large antenna. The ionosphere essentially is DC, or direct current, but by oscillating or causing it to vibrate in a specific way, it becomes more or less AC and acts as an antenna. Now, previously, they could create these kinds of effects using 14-mile-long and 28-mile-long antennas buried in the Earth or just traversing the surface of the Earth. In this case, they actually convert the ionosphere into that antenna, which then sends a secondary signal back to the Earth. It penetrates the Earth and sea and can be used for a number of purposes, one of them being communication with submarines, the other being Earth-penetrating tomography. And this is the idea of an active X-ray observer.